Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagolani-Albov.
Today we're going to be talking with Berilo Jackla from Humboldt University in Berlin.
Here we are in the middle of frozen Finnish winter, and today we are going to be going to another new perspective and region to talk about Kyrgyzstan and gold mining, which is going to be really a different perspective because this is going to be looking at extractivism in a post-Soviet space, which is not a space that we have previously looked at extractivism from.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this. Partially because I'm just really interested in Central Asia, and also because I feel like this is just something we don't look at quite enough. I mean, we always think of extractivism in this, in the sort of modern neoliberal capitalist system, but we don't look at it so much in this post-Soviet space, or indeed how extractivism was going on in the Soviet Union. But lots of interesting angles to take. So yeah, I guess enough from me. Welcome to the show, Beryl. Would you mind introducing yourself a bit for our listeners?
Hi, Sophia. Hi, Christopher. My name is Berilo Jackla. And first of all, thank you for having me. I'm very excited, looking forward to today's talk, having listened to your previous sessions. I am based in Berlin, Germany, at the Humboldt University. IRI thesis, it is an integrative research institute that studies transformations of human environment systems. And I have been working and researching resource governance in Kyrgyzstan and Central Asian context for quite some time now. And as a researcher, as a doctoral researcher since 2015, that sounds like a very long time, but in my defense, the first 3 years I have continued to work. And since 2018, I am focusing solely on my research, on understanding the drivers, dynamics of extractivism in Kyrgyzstan, and by way of how its gold rush has been made and at the same time unmade by persisting resistance throughout the country, in a nutshell.
That's really fascinating. And I mean, thank you so much for coming on, because as Sophia mentioned, this is just a huge, huge gap that we have had. And so I guess to kind of just get the ball rolling, how did you get into this sort of field of research? How did, like, you know, how did gold mine in Kyrgyzstan sort of come up for you?
Well, I guess there are two answers to that question, one that pertains Kyrgyzstan and the other one mining in Kyrgyzstan. Well, I will start with the most recent answer. I started working in extractive industries in Central Asian context 2012. And this is going to take an interesting turn for you and for your listeners. I started working in an international development corporation that unfolded with in cooperation with Federation of German Industries, and had the aim of officially helping partner countries in Central Asia and Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in quotes modernize their mining sector. And I have just recently come back from Tajikistan, where I was based the last 3 years. And I came back to Berlin, and I have to be honest, extractive industries were quite new to me. I did not really work in them, but the project was quite interesting for me because my role within would be to establish a dialogue platform, so to say, a transdisciplinary dialogue platform that could help trigger deliberations and policy processes around what to make out of mining industries in these countries, you know, very precisely being more aware of the social and ecological impacts, about a cost-benefit sharing. So now, to use all these buzzwords, basically, we can get deeper from there on. And participation processes, you know, making sure that local communities, affected communities, are being part of the mining concessions as they unfold. And so for 6 years, I led this initiative, a dialogue initiative that 3 to 4 times per year convened in a rotation basis, including Germany and the other times in Central Asian capitals, basically, on different topics. And each session was focused on a particular aspect of mining in Central Asian countries. And 3 years into my work, I started getting itchy feet. And one of our partner countries, Kyrgyzstan, had developed by then within the project, but also international dual open cooperation and business community for being quite rebellious. Because the communities would, you know, the expansion of mining would not sit well. And so while in the other countries, and then this was a huge project, by the way, and we had project teams in each of the countries that, you know, they have done other collaborations with different partners in the countries, whereas my role was only to lead these dialogue processes at a quite regional level. In contrast to Tajikistan and Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan started experiencing an upsurge in protests, anti-gold mining protests. And so by 2012, 2013, the protests started. They have become quite intensified. And so that was about the time our project started in 2015. After observing 3 years and getting to know the sector a bit, I realized that there were a lot of misconceptions and discourses about why the communities were protesting. And their protests were understood and interpreted from a perspective of barriers to development, the development of the modern Kyrgyzstan, basically. And having realized that neither the business community nor international development community have the resources and maybe in parentheses the interest to dwell on case-specific research, I decided I raised my hand within our project and I said, you know what, I will put on now a second hat and I will not just work in my role as a project lead, but also I want to take up on research and look a little bit closer in some of these cases. And that marks the beginning of my very paranoid phase, both as a practitioner and a researcher in Kyrgyzstan.
That sounds like it was an interesting trajectory. And I know a lot of people wear two hats, which I know can sometimes be hard because it's like you're practicing and you're researching. I have to admit, like, I've heard of Kyrgyzstan before, and I do have a little up on our audience that I have read one of your wonderful papers.
Thank you.
But can you give us a little bit of context about Kyrgyzstan itself and the region? I know that we teased in the intro that this is a post-Soviet space, so can you share with our listeners a little brief history of this area?
Sure. So the I think I will take just one step back into the Soviet era, because that is a very interesting, that is very telling for understanding Kyrgyzstan's contemporary problems. Kyrgyzstan joined the Soviet Socialist Republics in 1936, and until 1991 was officially known as Kyrgyz Socialist, Soviet Socialist Republic. So it was one of the many republics of the Union. And it has a quite mountainous geography, and as well as fertile soils and valleys. And that kind of set the scene for what kind of functions Kyrgyzstan would and Kyrgyzstan's geographies would be transformed into, with kind of resource geographies, basically to serve ideologies of the Soviet Union. And that meant intensive agricultural practices and mining industries, quite heavy mining industries. We are talking about mercury, uranium, antimony. It hosts some of the oldest coal mining regions in the Soviet Union. So especially following the Second World War, the focus on Kyrgyzstan, Soviet focus in Kyrgyzstan was expanding mining. A lot of work went into setting up geological infrastructure. We are talking about geographical, geophysical maps for rendering parts of nature as resources and making them legible and basically remaking nature for realizing the Soviet project of modernity, basically. So fast forward towards the end of 80s, Soviet economy approached this collapse, and I'm obviously making a huge shortcut. And but that's, you know, that's not our topic today. But so the economy started collapsing, basically, and the reform efforts under Perestroika, under Gorbachev's era, you know, to restructure the economy, they did not really bring the outcomes that were hoped for. And by 90s, beginning of 90s, basically, Kyrgyzstan was imposed independence, so to say. So this was not a glorious declaration of independence, but they would no longer be dependent on the Soviet subsidies, basically. And with that, a very tumultuous period started for the country and its citizens. The end of, or the collapse and decline of the economy was not new, certainly. Many people have realized that the subsidies have been falling throughout 18s, and poverty started increasing. Not the ruling elite nor the country's inhabitants were really prepared for when this moment really came. And so basically they were left, many people were left on their own, and they had to grapple with what this transition was, transition to what, you know, and with which means. So and in another sentence, officially what happened was that, being in this dire economic situation, the government of the then independent Kyrgyz Republic decided that, well, less of a decision, but, you know, had not much choice but to basically follow the prescriptions of international financial institutions. So we are talking about World Bank Group, IMF, etc. And instead of this subsidies from the Soviet Union that were failing, they were really in need of liquidity and public finances. And it was suggested by the international donor community, by international financial institutions, to follow the path of a shock therapy. So we are talking about different sorts of neoliberalisms, basic neoliberalizations. And in exchange for a grant and loans. And interestingly enough, so, you know, overnight, officially overnight, of course, unofficially not overnight, but officially overnight, we see the end of the Soviet order and the entrance of the new neoliberal order, a huge contrast, really. And despite this this crass contrast, the focus of this era becomes set as turning towards extractive industries for leading modern Kyrgyzstan's way. And from there on, the country gets its first large-scale gold licensing agreement for development of its Kumtor gold mine to a Canadian mining company. And Kumtor Gold Mine is a permafrost mine, operates at 4,000 meters above sea level. It involves tapping mountains, removing glaciers. And since 1998, if I recall it correctly, the first cyanide disaster that happened around the operations of this gold mining. Gold has irreversibly changed countries' perception of gold mining and relations to basically nature and the government or the governance that the way governance deals with the nature, so to say.
Wow. I mean, there's so much there. I mean, I find like just a few different things popping into my head, especially like going back to when you were describing the Soviet times and the Soviet approach of, you know, kind of breaking things down to look at the potential resources. Of course, being a nice example of how extractivism or an extractivist mindset is not necessarily simply a feature of capitalism, but of course of the more state-led industries. But like really like coming off of that, and I mean, this is something that I really want to tap into, is really looking at the this interaction of people and nature. Because I mean, like, I know a bit about Central Asian history, you know, like the various cultures and the steppe and the you know, traditionally nomadic practices, which of course is still, you know, very much in the hearts of a lot of the traditional cultures. But anyways, like, so this is like a very strong connection to nature with a lot of these traditional lifestyles. And like, just hearing this, like, you know, tearing down mountains, basically destroying glaciers in a time when, like, you know, glaciers have already got a hard enough business going on as it is. To be actively destroying them is scary. And then you just hear the term, not just cyanide disaster, but first cyanide disaster.
Yeah, yikes.
So, I mean, I guess, like, yeah, so what's, I mean, yeah, if you could dive a bit more into this and these, like, you know, kind of the nexus of people's livelihoods, nature, and I guess I'd imagine resistance, as you had mentioned before.
Yeah, I also, one disclaimer for the listeners is that, you know, we are talking about Kyrgyzstan from a very specific perspective on a very specific topic, right? Because there's an adamant community of Central Asian scholars and scholars researching on Central Asia, and it is really, the issues are quite intricate and complex, and that, you know, prevail over centuries, really. So that's that. But from our point of interest, it is quite interesting. I'm thinking where to start. Probably it makes sense to start from the beginning. So yes, you rightly pointed out nomadism, and it was part of the struggle at the beginning of Kyrgyzstan actually becoming part of the Soviet Union. It was not a smooth transition, because then through this process, they have become sedentized. And they are people of mountains and pastures, basically. And it is, you know, at this point, I think would be correct to say it's not just a source of livelihood, but a way of life. And that is part of, important part of their life works. And so we see from 30s on, a process of bringing modernization to life of Kyrgyz people, and along the identified areas, strategic areas for modernization. So, you know, we are talking about large-scale collectivization of agriculture and extractive industries. Kyrgyzstan's social fabric changes due to also influx of technocrats and engineers from different parts of Soviet Union. And from 40s on and 50s on, mining gets really intensified. And it is quite interesting, the making of what I'm right now working on conceiving, making of the Soviet socio-natures from the moment on which Kyrgyzstan becomes part of the Soviet Union and until independence, how socio-natures were made, and part of that was really the mining industries. And it was actually not only the geological infrastructure or the engineering, but it was also, so being a miner, being a geologist was a very venerable, very respected and very privileged profession. And so it was part of, it was discursively mediated to make mining and miners, the whole sector basically, a part of fulfilling Soviet ideals and ideologies. And one of the ways was actually creation of urban utopian settlements. These were called model mining towns. And in Kyrgyzstan, at some point, I think there were 20 of those mining towns. And there is even a phrase for that, urban type settlement. I think this is, Kyrgyzstan is not the exception, but these urban type settlements were created as urban utopias around the, you know, we would think about business clusters, a new idea or incubation, stuff like that. No, it's not. You know, there were clusters formed around mine deposits, different deposits, for making this profession and the services that miners provided to the union basically respectable, and they were privileges. It was a very privileged profession within the Soviet Union because there was based on the subsidies received from the Soviet Union, the families of miners basically received different access to social infrastructure. They had what is called direct provisioning from Moscow, and it was something very special when you received your goods that of course changed the invariance to the other locally available products. It was something, you know, and it was not just the products or the number of the hospitals or kindergartens that were there around these urban utopias, but this actually became part of the identity of being a Soviet miner. And it was a very, it was something, you know, people have done with pride. And also the mining towns enjoyed a lot of privilege and prominence. And so you can only expect how disastrous the transition, you know, again in quotations, or having all of this taken away basically, or the collapse of the system, you know, that you based your life but also your identity just collapsing with the Soviet economy basically and the union. And in one of the cases, for example, that I am looking into in the north of country, Arlovka called the town, there have been rare earth metal mining for many years. And I conducted research 2018, I think the whole town, 2018, and you know, the independence was 91. After so many years, still you could feel the depression that the city went through. It was clearly designed at some point or redesigned as a town. So it was a very urban settlement, and many high-rise buildings that were collapsed. And these collapsed buildings were still standing there. There was a different flair to the city when I was there because things were evolving and changing, and a new mine, and this is kind of the irony of the whole thing, was opened, this time a gold mine. And also quite a lot of time has passed since the independence, and, you know, people at some point had to get out of their depression, economic and psychological depression. So they actually started to pick up themselves. But so you realize that talking to the residents in Arlovka, you realize how hard the loss of mining was felt there. You know, they had lost part of their identity, and having specialized on mining, they did not have a lot of knowledges and experience with land that other parts of the country had, you know, because it was according to the specializations that, you know, that then decided on your position and somehow maybe more privileged role or power within the society. And so they did not know where to start with, you know, they were quite used to the urban style and working in the factories. And they started kind of collecting themselves around 2000s, I guess. So pretty much for 10, 15 years, it was a very bad time for Arlovka. Many people left, actually, who could go, went, you know, and in recollections of my interlocutors, it's people just look back and they say that it was a time that the old went, but new would not come. And Arlovka held on to, actually, the imaginaries of improvements, you know, because now, you know, the socio-spatial imaginaries of neoliberalism or liberalism. Now it is a democratic country. Now we are free. Now we are independent. And then expecting for improvement of betterment that did not come was quite devastating, but they held on to that. And eventually a new mine, starting from 2012, 2013, so these were the construction phases, a new mine was opened. So And then it kind of added to their sense of, again, stability, that on this basis they can build up again. And the mine in Arlovka is called Altınken, and it is the third largest gold mine in the country. And that started production in 2015. And such cases as Arlovka are quite problematic. Apart from actually embracing the return of gold mine, they have their own problems, or it doesn't mean that, you know, they have different ways of resisting mining. The problem is that it is a large-scale mine, and it is the state, the ruling elite and corporate actors would like to talk about such cases as Arlovka as a paragon of a successful company-community relations, you know, repackaging a former mining town as a successful neoliberal mining. But through my research, I have found out that this is not quite the case. It is not a case of cooperation, or better said, cases like Arlovka really complicate what cooperation and conflict and resistance means, because there's not a neat binary between the good community, bad community, you know, good mining, bad mining, but it's all of these things. And there are reasons for people to allow mining, reject mining, negotiate with mining. However, the discourses that I study or follow are quite strong, and I come to understand them as tactics of rolling out the neoliberal imaginaries in new extractive frontiers.
You know what's really interesting? As you're telling this story and giving us some insight into like these lived experiences that are happening in this place, I don't know about you, Christopher, but I'm kind of like remembering the conversation that we had with Tom Marafa talking about some of the changes that had happened in rural America, where, you know, there was highly destructive natural resource extraction going on, and then it left. And then there was just kind of a void for the area. So it really, like, I think that it's interesting that in such different kind of contexts, the same kind of patterns can emerge even under such different circumstances. So yeah, that's really interesting. So what do these new neoliberal imaginaries, how do those play out? What does that look like?
Well, you know, they are nothing specific to Kyrgyzstan, because you know, we are working towards flattening the world, and you know, we will all have equal opportunities and better lives, the growth and prosperity. But many places in Kyrgyzstan, especially those that were confronted early on with extractive expansion under neoliberal governance, have, of course, it took them a minute, but have made their experiences with what was promised, and then the public speeches and public discourses of mining, how important it is to lift the country up and bring progress and industrialization to Kyrgyzstan. And it's one thing to hear about the hearing about these narratives, but you know, sooner or later you actually find out what it means, or does it even pan out, or how the neoliberalizations basically unfold where they live. And it is part of the ongoing resistance since so many years now. And going back to Christopher's question, which I am realizing only answered probably like 20% of it, because we were talking about glaciers and changing society nature relations, we have to contextualize that, all that, in this transition period. And then that's why I am trying to also give insights into, you know, the pre-independence and then the first years of independence, is that the very dire economic situation in which people were told that they are now independent. And what independence means, you know, I did not start out to research about this at all, but in each and every interview and conversation I had, it is this part that, in an unasked way, that we go back to the Soviet period, the transition. There is a pattern, but in diverging ways and situated ways, how they experienced what independence meant and what the price for that. And so when Kumtor was licensed and it started productions, and I have to now throw in some numbers, Only this gold mine accounts around 9 to 10% of the country's GDP. Yes. And depending on whether or not the production is stopped by protests or not, contributes to around 30 to 40% of industrial output of the country. So it is a mammoth project, and it is what country has been relying on. It is basically the crazy idea that immense dependence on one mine continues like this. But so for this period, the first 10 years of independence, it was, of course, for many a great signal, because country is opening up and investors are coming. So the old is gone. And, you know, people have been living from five-year plans to five-year plans, and then there was no plan anymore, the planned economy. And so what were they, you know, what is there to look forward to? And so within that context, of course, Kum Tor was at first a good development. However, just a year after its operation, a truck full of cyanide solution spilled into a main river, and it has taken until now over 20 years to some of the people to get basically some sort of repairman from the company. It has taken so long, and I don't know how many court cases and you know how many cases have been filed really. And from the first, and I'm again saying yeah, and after that there were two, I think, more times of where cyanide again trucks spilled, and but also pollution of rivers or breaking tailing dams is not an they are not isolated cases in neither in Kyrgyzstan nor worldwide. When we look at, I mean, Brumadinho, I think recently it was 2 years after Brumadinho, I cannot call it an accident, but let's say catastrophe. And so starting with reactions to the cyanide pollution, we see the very slowly a change in why people protest. At first, it is about compensation, because they were shocked, and they could not even grapple with the dimensions of what this all mean, and they were worried about their produce, because all of a sudden, of course, the region got a bad name, and they suffered for that. They suffered from health problems. But then from 2010, 2011, 12 on, with the political situation, and I have to add here, Kyrgyzstan had three national uprisings. So three presidents have been ousted to date. The latest was in 2020. And 2010, when the second uprising happened, and the president at the time was ousted, it all had also related with the people finding out about the extent of business and criminal infiltration in politics. So from there on, we see how people start understanding that, you know, in Swingedal's words or footsteps, how things are really just a myriad composite of all these processes, you know. And then, it is just interesting from a point of researcher, but also as people live there, that they have realized what is nature and what is society. They are really extremely intertwined, and you cannot draw a line between the physical attributes of gold and what we make out of it. You know, and with business infiltration, I just want to say keyword corruption. People have found that because gold is, you know, is an export commodity, through Kyrgyzstan's now new position as part of the global capitalism, connections to offshore networks enabled plundering of gold rents, millions and millions of dollars. And so from there on, from this realization, of course, the nature of protests are changing, and what people want becomes not anymore compensation. And they also at first try to work with corporate social responsibility approaches, and then they try to get out of these approaches what they used to get under the Soviet state, because of course, yes, they were mining, but there was a social component to that. There was a social structure. There were the model mining towns. Yet under neoliberal governance, they are left to their own devices with the companies, basically, right? So where is the responsibility? So they are seeing, experiencing an irresponsible state. By now, you know, it is not just an isolated case that these incidents keep happening. And yet again, what they see as a corporate social responsibility is also not matching with their sense of responsibility, because they slowly understand how low or shallow these schemes are and what they are really. And then the question from there on really becomes about future and about alternatives. And from there on, the question becomes about justice and also transnational justice in that sense, because the gold that is being seen, extracted, and exported somewhere, and the rents out of that, where do they end up? And what do we have as people who lose then their social natures behind?
Thank you so much for that. I mean, this is just so fascinating to me, because I mean, I knew so little about this coming in. And I mean, not that I'm exactly an expert or anything now, but this is really eye-opening. And going back to what Sophie had mentioned, like there is a lot that reminds me of the kind of relations. We talked with Tom Marafa about like rural Ohio and coal mining there, and that sort of sense of wanting to go back and how that influences like politics and right-wing politics and da-da-da. But like there's this importance of identity though, and how much like this identity of being an extractive industry has gotten into people's beings and their community, and showing that, like, you know, this is good enough for my parents, this is good enough for my grandfather. You know, I can, like, you know, I can raise a good family doing this stuff, and how tough it can be. But I'm also really curious to kind of tease out here a bit more about, I guess, now that people are seeing that these neoliberal companies are not nearly matching the sort of respect and prestige, and certainly not the social aspects of the mining towns of the USSR. I'm really curious to hear more about these alternatives and like what people are really pushing for out of this.
Yes, thanks for going back to connecting basically the identity to alternatives in the future. And let me think. I guess I'll start with saying that identity was one of these I don't know, mid-range concepts that got thrown at me. I am not really studying in any explicit way or theorizing about identity, but researching this topic in this context, in the post-Soviet context of Kyrgyzstan, really threw this concept at me, because especially when it came to towns like Arlovka that being part of the model mine and making of Soviet ideals was really an extremely important part of their identity. And that they lost. And when you talk to people in such places or particularly in Arlovka, there is an extreme amount of melancholy, and especially by the older generations who spent who grew up in the Soviet Union, so to say, that they were not just that they were born, but they at least spent 20-30 years in the Soviet Union, and even longer. I even met actually former geologists, you know, and the pride with which they talk about the things they have done. And it is also fascinating. And I do not want to silence these experiences too, because this was a period that the miners or geologists really had enjoyed to an extent. Of course, the disastrous effects of extractivism during the Soviet time became only later widely known, but for the time being, as they render these resources legible and remade nature, they were part of something that was that had a sense, that had a utopian goal, and they knew for what it was. And under the neoliberal governance, many people around the country asked themselves for what. So they don't have this purpose. And this is, I don't want to in any way compare which extractivism fares better, or this is not the point of it, but I see that there are differences in how it is being experienced and interpreted. And in this way, the contemporary mining in Kyrgyzstan is being received as, I would say, I think it's safe to say, more reckless, especially comparing it to the promises of liberal rights of democracy, of participatory deliberation, all these things with which the independence started. And then, you know, they have now a good data set of over 30 years. And looking back, they can compare very well which of these imaginaries panned out and which did not. And so in Arlovka, the identity becomes mixed because mining for them has a different place. Because, as I said, it's part of their identity. But that doesn't mean that they are romanticizing anymore or blind to the tactics and practices and discourses of that are part and parcel of making extractivism work, because they have been also fighting. That is not very largely known in the media, but they have been fighting in different ways, basically illiberal ways of this neoliberal governance that tries to exclude, oppress, and silence the concerns that Arlovka has, despite consenting to the mine, despite actually wanting to have the mine work, that the company and the ruling elite choose to silence, basically. And that is interesting, because wanting the mine at this point in my interpretation for Arlovka is actually for the future. This is a basis. So this is a basis for which they can imagine they have something to look forward to. But many people are engaging in different forms of livelihoods. So it is not the one and only thing that defined their identity. Also, with that, I think what I want to say is that it is still an important part of their past, of their remembrances and melancholy over the Soviet days. But their identity is also getting different colors, so to say, because they also have made their experiences and frustrated with the ways that the new order unfolded. But about identity, I want to talk about briefly about a whole different story, again in the same country. I will take you now towards southwest, west of the country, that is located in the Fergana Valley. Fergana Valley is a valley that is shared by three countries, basically Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, and it is known as the agricultural heartland of the region. And the other case that I have been looking into is the case of a Maidan rural community, and then, you know, moving from urban Arlovka to rural Maidan. I have come across different issues, really, and I will just, you know, provide you a snapshot of why I am studying Maidan at all. In 2007, an Australian junior company discovers gold reserves. So this is the first post-Soviet discovery by a private company, and it means quite a lot to this private company, and it means nothing to Maidan or people of Maidan, basically. Anyway, so from finding, they find in 2007 gold, and they receive different numbers of licenses from 2005 to 2012, and at the end they receive license to actually develop the mine. And yet, when they receive the first excavator to actually start the construction phase, the road construction, people violently push back the excavator and the company workers. And I'm skipping a lot of details, but I think to give you an idea why I'm talking about this is that 2013 is the last time actually that mining a legal license holder set foot in Maidan. Since over 7 years, no company worker or representative has been able to get access to the deposit, maybe come near, but then again met again with wild or loud protests, basically. And so what is going on there is that Maidan does not want gold. They don't want extractivism. They don't want the expansion of whatever that is going to come and whatever is going to reproduce the images of what they have been seeing through Kumtor's case. You know, we were speaking about glaciers or cyanide spills. Whatever the extractive order does in Kyrgyzstan, they don't want any of that. And part of it is that during the Soviet Union, they were working mostly in agriculture production. And they were, you know, they knew this, and Maidan is located in a very actually heavy mining region. But having a rural geography and having worked in agriculture, they have no connection. They have no connection to mining or the glory and then the prominence of mining, really. And when the independence happened, they were hit not less hard, but they do not have an vulnerable identity of, you know, the Soviet past and whatnot to dwell on. And of course, they realize what, again, this independence meant, that was basically being left alone to your devices. They did receive from mid-90s on land plots that then saved their lives, but they have a different approach. And they have a different recollection of the Soviet times. And that is very telling about how making of Soviet geographies have also been transforming socio-nature relations and influencing today's relations to nature in Maidan and places like in Maidan. And what is the alternative for Maidan? Or let me flip it the other way around. You know, Maidan has developed its own alternatives when they were left alone in this deregulated space, that they have rebuilt their lives on the basis of agriculture. And many people engage in horticulture and they export to Kazakhstan and Russia. We're talking about, you know, fruits and vegetables, and none of them are really rich or extremely affluent. But what they tell me is that they have enough. They have enough and they have a good life. And that is, and I really don't want this to come as a romanticized version of reality, because it's not. But when they say they have enough, or their reaction to gold mining or its potential expansion is, of course, in relation to what they have rebuilt, what is at stake, and what they have observed and experienced of what happens in other mine places in their country. And they know when things go south, and they do, they will be again left alone. And this time they have a lot to lose. You know, they're not at the beginning of their independence with nothing in their hands. They have rebuilt a whole life for themselves and own institutions. You know, they have realized what deregulation means, and embracing this, how bitter it was, they have become part of re-regulating basically the governance, in that they are crafting and reinforcing own institutions of trustful local mechanisms, of taking responsibility for actions, and coming to a point of saying that gold extractivism or extractivism in Maidan is not negotiable. There is nothing the company can say at this point. The number of the boreholes they take, or, you know, the respected members of the academy they work with, or the millions of dollars that will, you know, flow into the development funds. What they are saying is that none of this is interesting to us, because they realize at this point, you know, when the company loses access to the sites, corporate social responsibility approaches become just a mechanism of trying to get social license to operate. And from there on, it becomes a power struggle over whose knowledges, valuations, and social natures will count at the end. And so in a total different way to Alokas resistance, everyday resistance in Maidan, they resist because they already had alternatives. And safeguarding these alternatives is what motivates Maidan's resistance and activism.
Those are two really different trajectories of first making the Soviet space, unmaking the Soviet space, and then remaking the space. I think that, and not just the space, but also the social identity within the space. I think it's amazing how two places can be faced with circumstances and go in such different paths. But it's really heartening to hear that there are spaces that the extractivist push and the extractivist mindset is being pushed back against, because I know that, you know, in a lot of places, it can be kind of seductive in a way, because there are promises that come in. But I'm heartened to hear that there's this whole area where their own alternative and their own kind of way of life was, you know, viewed as precious enough before it was too late.
I totally agree with you, and I really find it's very inspiring, and I think I have grown a lot through seeing my dance struggle. I lived 2 months in the village, and I was the only foreigner at all to be allowed in the village after 2013. And it was a very, very challenging time for both sides, because they have not until the last day really they could not get rid of the suspicion that I might be a spy or I might be working for a company. And I was afraid of being kicked out, really. It was a very tense situation for both of us, but I now truly understand their fears, because a company in different ways tried to get back, of course, to Maidan through different mechanisms. And but what I want to say still is that Maidan is staying with trouble. So for the moment, gold does not become Maidan, but we have to be cautious with observing how it is going to develop. There is a new investor, a Chinese investor since 2017 that now has declared a switch to a non-cyanide method of leaching. And when I was in Maidan, I was told constantly how the whole settlement would be sitting on a gold mine. And when you're in the field, it can get quite intense and you're taking it all in, but you don't know necessarily how to order things. And it was, thank God, only after my fieldwork that I came across maps of the company that showed mineralized trends, showing basically their plans of expanding explorations literally all around this settlement. So I don't know, of course, if something comes out of it or not, but adding this to a narrative that kept recounted to me was that because this deposit they found is very small. So it would be developed in 5 years, and they have been alone waiting almost 8 years for this amount of gold. And what has been told to me many times in Maidan is that they are not waiting only for 8 tons of gold. There is so much more. This could be true, this could not be true, but what I want to say is that we don't know really how much gold there is in Maidan. And my fear is that when there is really a lot of gold, then the space for re-regulation will very quickly, very immensely shrink, because then Maidan will become the catch interest of Bishkek, center of governance, and it will present itself a very lucrative source for short-term gains.
I think one of the things that's so chilling about this, and you touched on it just now, is that what's going to be the outcome of this, you know, that it's still an ongoing process. And I think one of the things that kind of comes to mind is, you know, these places, this place, this real place that has these kind of these extractivist industries focused on it. This, and I hope I can say this in a way that makes sense. It's very profound in my mind, so I hope it comes out just as profound. But it's like this place is full of people. There's people in this place that are like actual real people who are trying to live their lives. And then they have this like machinery of extractivism kind of hovering over them, this machinery of these extractive companies. And the companies, while we know that it's people that work for the companies, at the same time, the companies themselves aren't real people just trying to live their lives. So it's like a wave that keeps crashing against something. And I hope that, you know, the people in the place cannot get tired, if that makes sense. Did I say that nicely?
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. And a while ago, a couple of weeks ago, I actually reconnected with an interlocutor from Maidan, a former policeman in Maidan. And I was quite nervous to reconnect again because, you know, as I said, I also evolved quite a lot in my position as a researcher. And I was afraid to reconnect and to hear that they give in or they get tired or, you know. And what he told me is that now their resistance has been growing and the nearby settlements have joined them too in their efforts, and that not even the switch to cyanide, non-cyanide option is attractive for them. I really hope that they get a chance to keep their space for imagining and innovating basically the social practices, mechanisms that make them, you know, lead meaningful lives, because this is what it is about. And they might not have enough compared to any other standards, but they have enough for themselves. And I think this is very inspiring coming out of Kyrgyzstan and from the post-Soviet space, that they say that it is not, you know, neoliberalism came and saved people from Soviet order, that the, it is just, it, it, and it is, this is an alternative to both ways. You know, this is an alternative. What they have found is that alternative to the days of the gone Soviet order. And by now they know also created tremendous disasters. And they also imagine things beyond beyond things that were promised by a liberal, neoliberal order that proved itself to be quite irresponsible, really. And this is their life at stake. And that is, I think, what the story of their resistance is. It's about their life projects, their achievements, and having something to look forward to. In that sense, their futures.
Definitely. And I mean, this is, it's so fascinating to me hearing all this. And I, this might seem kind of strange or silly to say, but like hearing all this, I think back to the conceptualization of the world eater, like this extractivism that is coming in and like almost like a voracious beast. It's, I know it's kind of funny, but it's, but really it's, I think of that, or I think of almost like it's almost mythical in a way, thinking of like vampires or demons, where it's like this seductive sort of force that's being held at bay because of solidarity against it. But it just takes one greedy person or one thing like that to possibly break the whole thing. So, I mean, I know it's kind of strange, but it's like, I don't know why, it just sort of, that sort of imagery popped into my head of, you know, these like sort of demonic sort of forces, which I know is over the top and not fair. I'm sure there are lovely people who work for mining companies, but it's just sort of a very interesting sort of way. And of course, it also, I think that it's helpful in like the fact that they're still there, that they're not giving up, is an interesting thing too. Like, and I guess another thing that pops into my head is, you know, it's not just good for their community, but I'm sure it's, this is practically transnational, because you were talking about the importance of this valley to multiple countries and to agriculture and everything like that. So it's like, if they did do something that was massively polluting, if there's an accident, that's not going to stay just there. That's going to mess up things for a bunch of different people across different borders. So, I mean, you know, it's hopefully this can keep spreading and they can be strong. But I know that we've been taking a lot of your time, and it's really wonderful to have you on here. And it's been such a fascinating conversation. I guess we're probably running out of time, though. So, you know, at the end of every episode, we like to ask the question.
The question. Oh, my God. It's the question.
The question.
Question time.
So, of course, the question is for our listeners, wherever they might be. They're listening, they're hearing all about this, they are inspired, they want to do something, they want to learn more. For those people, what can they do? How can they learn more? How can they get involved somehow? Or how can they make a difference if they're so inclined?
Well, I guess it depends who these people are. You know, if they are researchers themselves, or just interested people who hear about Kyrgyzstan for the first time. But I guess generally, it's always safe to start with the general. I think generally, try to be, you know, before going anywhere and doing anything or volunteerism or anything, please, oh God, no. But where you could start would be, is to be aware of things you consume, aware of things you wear, you use, and having an bodily awareness of where things come from. They are coming from somewhere. They're coming from people's lives. They're extracted from people's lives. And have this connection into have this connection to your production pattern, so to say, you know, and perhaps with more awareness, you might do more sustainable choices towards, you know, in a spectrum gradient of consuming less or consuming other things. And also, because alternatives to extractivism are intertwined with alternatives to our production patterns, you know, consumption and production, especially in mining, gets displayed so disconnected, yet they are not. You know, we all have gold in somewhere in our homes, or we all use metals. that are being produced for our cars, for our phones and stuff like that. You know, I don't have to go through the whole list of things, but I think the first thing would be really awareness. And with that, once that gets switched on or sharpened, then you might also have an interest for actually looking for these countries. And in case of Kyrgyzstan, there are a number of documentary films made. Of course, Kumtor is prominently figured, and there is a strong environmental activism now that is been emerging from Kumtor, but now spreading out as we have spoken. So, you know, if you have a continued interest, then I would suggest to have a look at these documentary films. And then, you know, from mining on, there are different forms of extractivisms, you know, and there are the huge mega projects and infrastructure projects and hydropower dams. And also about that, there are a lot of documentaries, including recently one that I have seen on Georgia. And so different ways in which extractivism enters people's lives. And so I guess I wouldn't go any more farther than that. I think that's quite a lot. And for the researchers, I know that the extractivism community is quite diverse, and I'm very proud if one can be of this community, how reflected, how diverse, and how critical it is. So I guess what I want to say does not necessarily now apply for our community of researchers and practitioners, but I have not. I was not born in this community, let's put it that way. I have roots in institutional economics, and through the course of researching and working and living and seeing with peoples that I have been listening to, that I have allowed to broaden my perspective and position as a researcher as well. You know, the things that we spoke about today would probably come out in very different ways, or perhaps would not come out in some ways if I was just out of my dorm a couple of years ago. So I think, long story short, I want to say is that I think a commitment to telling stories where they come from, and a commitment to people who have the courage to oppose something that's so humongous and so beyond their, you know, capacity of a community. I think we should have also more courage to have a commitment to the stories that they are doing so bravely. As I said, this is probably, it is already what I observe in the extractivism community. It applies more to, this call is probably to myself many years ago, who was observing things and thinking and questioning, criticizing things, but on her own. And now finally, you know, over the years, has found the voice and then courage to actually take sides, because none of this, what we talk about, is neutral. And one of the things that really towards the end of my occupation, or also in geology of things, you know, in the infrastructure of mining, bugs me to say in very plainly, is the presumptuous neutrality of knowledge. You know, they are just, they're how they are maps, how they are scientific facts, and then it becomes a struggle of, you know, whose facts count, and of course they are not neutral. So just a call for reminding ourselves, either growing the courage towards moving that trajectory, or just reminding ourselves that.
Well, that is a fantastic answer. And I think that is actually one of the best answers to the question that we've heard. I'll make sure to touch base with you and get some of the names of some of those documentaries. And we'll make sure to put some of those good titles down in the show notes for you listeners that are interested to hear more about this specific space. In addition, we'll also link to your published articles about this if people want to read more. Is there anywhere else that you would like to tell our listeners to learn more about what it is you're doing?
Well, I guess we will link the institute that I am based at in Berlin, and the usual suspects of ResearchGate and Twitter. I am in the final phase of wrapping up my research, but I'm really very keen on exchanging, having these kind of conversations that today we had, to connecting to the wider extractivism community. So, yeah.
Great. We will make sure that that is all down below. So hopefully people will take that call to action too and continue these great conversations.
Definitely. Beryl, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully we can have you back on again sometime in the future, perhaps after you take the big, I guess now, virtual walk across the stage.
That would be really awesome. And really, thank you so much, Chris and Sophia, for having me and actually for doing this work that you're doing. I think that is very important to also provide space for the very different stories of how extractivism proceeds, progresses, unfolds, and extracts. Thank you so much.
A huge thank you to Beryl Ojakla for coming on and having such a great conversation covering both extractivisms and alternatives with us. Please join us next month when we will be talking with Saski Assassin about the extractive nature of the financial industry and how it finds ways to squeeze money out of everyone, even people it previously thought had too little to bother with. From the spring-resisting piles of snow and sheets of ice of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Alabov, take care, stay safe, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.